there. Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in once again. This week, I am joined by a gentleman called Kevin Birkhoff. Kevin is the CEO and co-founder of Quantum Diamonds, which, interestingly, is a quantum sensing startup slash scale-up based in Munich, Germany. Their mission is to make the invisible visible. So they are developing, or have developed, atom-sized quantum sensors using nitrogen vacancies in diamonds. They are used to detect magnetic fields, and their mission is to build a global sensing platform that enables advancements across a variety of fields, from the semiconductor manufacturing industry to biotechnology and chemistry. That's my intro, so let's get into it. Thank you. All right, well, Kevin, thank you for joining us today. This is a very interesting spin-off from our previous recordings about quantum networking. We're taking a bit of a dive into the sensing world here. Kevin, why don't you give us a bit of your background? How did you get into quantum? And what was your path, your career path, before getting into working for Quantum Diamonds? It'd be really interesting to hear. I think you have a slightly different route in compared to some others.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. So I think what is very interesting is that I'm the only non-quantum physicist in our team. So I actually have a pure business background. So studied international management, first in Cologne in Germany, and then did a master's in Lisbon in Portugal and in Milan in Italy. Afterwards, or as part of the studies, did a lot of internships in various fields. And then, as many business guys, I ended up in consulting. So worked for McKinsey for 3 years, did a lot of projects in different industries, mainly in the private equity field. So a lot of due diligences, companies being bought, being acquired. And then actually, as part of the LEAF program at McKinsey, started a PhD at the Technical University of Munich, also at the business field, but then was actually involved in quite a lot of courses at the university where also many technical PhDs were present. And there I actually met Fleming, our CTO, or now CTO at that time, a PhD student at the Technical University of Munich. And he told me he's working on diamonds and quantum. So I didn't know anything about it, right? So I didn't have a lot of quantum experience. I know that, for example, McKinsey did also some work in terms of technology innovation and quantum monitor, how the landscape evolves, but never heard of quantum sensing before. And then at some point, there was a large German conglomerate, Bosch, that actually approached the research group and asked if they could buy one of these quantum sensors. And I was a bit surprised because I know a bit about the corporate world. So it usually is very uncommon that a large conglomerate reaches out to your university research group, right? So this was the first point where I thought, okay, maybe there's something behind it, like a business case. And then we jointly looked at it. So I looked mostly from the business side, the application side, and Fleming looked a lot at the technical feasibility. So we tried to understand the different use cases where these sensors can be applied. And then at some point found very interesting use cases, started the company. And I think we go into the details about the company in a second.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear your perspective. Often that these things start with a chat with a colleague or a combining of different perspectives. So tell us a bit about the company. What's the size, the scale of the company at the moment, and what are your goals going forward? I think you've recently had some funding as well, right? So if you could talk us through, that'd be good.
Yep. So we started the company 1.5 years ago, so pretty new company still. Finalized a seed funding round in December, 4 months ago. In total, 8 million, a combination of private and public capital from leading VC investors, Early Bird from Germany, IQ Capital from the UK, but then also a couple of smaller VCs joining First Momentum, on-site ventures from Austria. So a lot of investors that not only bring deep financial pockets, but also experience in at least a couple of the verticals we are targeting. We now have established our own kind of headquarter combination of lab infrastructure and office. So now we completely left the university setting and are 15 people. I'm the only non-quantum physicist, so highly technical team. And yeah, we are about to launch the first product. You can think of it as a microscope where you can do detailed analysis wherever you want to measure physical properties very precisely, and are still continue to hire, continue to onboard new people from this field, and enlarging the team. That would be the milestones, I'd say, for this year.
And so you founded the company in Munich. Were you able to leverage some of the government initiatives in Germany for getting your company off the ground?
Yes. So we actually started before we started the company. So there's one funding scheme called Exist. It's like a founder scholarship. So basically it pays 3 base salaries for founders for 12 months. And this is where we applied to. It's intended to bring deep tech to entrepreneurial activities. And that's actually what we got. So Christina Fleming, the 2 PhDs, and me for a year to prepare founding the company. And afterwards, we also received funding as part of this 8 million seed round from the EIC, the EIC Accelerator program that you might know of. But then also there's a state level funding from the Bavarian government. It's called the Munich Quantum Valley. And there we could also leverage 1.5 million. That's highly attractive from a founder's perspective, because in the end, it's non-dilutive. And of course, also attractive to private investors. If we're talking about quantum, it's still, yeah, deep tech and requires deep pockets.
You both went to TU Munich, didn't you? Do you think you guys might have crossed paths unwittingly at some point in the past?
Perhaps. I was there from 2015 to 2021.
We might. I mean, it's a huge university, right? You always, in hindsight, realize that you should have met someone, but you never actually talked to them. So.
Yeah, I was in math first, and then I moved to the city in electrical engineering. I think that if you're in the physics group, I know the back of the campus in Goshing, that's where all the quantum stuff's going on.
Yeah.
Keep it in. So maybe one time.
So Kevin, you mentioned Bosch earlier on. Are you still working with them at all?
Yeah, so we still, I mean, it's a kind of close community, right? So there's no new entrant that somebody that comes at one point and then leaves. So it's a very close net, I would say. And we're still in contact. So they are focusing mainly on the medical field, but also pretty exciting technology. And the community is small, so we keep the exchange ongoing.
So which part of Bosch is it? You said the medical use case. Is that for magnetoencephalography?
Yeah, they don't reveal too much, but this is something that they actively look at. And I think it's still part of the corporate research. So I think they still figure out where to put it in the big corporate structure. But I think it's under the corporate research right now.
Yeah, I mean, I know Bosch a little bit, and it's no surprise that they were reaching out to universities in Germany. They're like a innovation engine, really connected to all parts of the country, right?
Yeah, they're well connected, but at the same time, it's still, I would say, a different game founding within Bosch with all the resources and founding a kind of standalone company. It has pros and cons. I would say the flexibility and the speed is something that probably you can better leverage if you're a standalone company, but it's still like a great corporate and great infrastructure and resources that they have.
Yeah. I think it's also not as uncommon that the industry companies come to the universities, because especially with quantum, particularly with quantum, because quantum is actually behind in industry, I think, compared to academics, and even in lab settings. So these bulk optics, bulk experimental designs is cutting edge. It's as far as it goes. So they don't have as much as the university. So
yeah. Yeah, true. We see the same if we are now in the hiring part and try to get experienced talent from the industry. There's no experienced talent in the industry, right? People come from university, and if they have 3 to 5 years PhD experience in the field, that's the most advanced or the most experienced talent profile you can actually get. I think this connects well to corporates reaching out to research groups directly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the products that you have. Give us a bit of a deep dive on what you've got on the truck, so to speak, as they say. But actually, how you've got to this point in time, right? Because and I would expect there's been some kind of iteration of development as you've gone through. So it would be interesting to hear that.
Yep. So we started with the hypothesis that you can sell these quantum sensors to many, many different industries, right? So in the end, if you think about a magnetic field sensor, it can be used in whatever industry needs magnetic field sensing. And if you look closer, it's biology, chemistry, semiconductor manufacturing, battery, almost all materials you can investigate using magnetic field sensing. So we thought in a couple of years, there might be many industries needing these quantum sensors. And that's become the one-stop shop where everyone buys, right? So the hypothesis was Bosch is developing it for healthcare. Siemens is developing it for medical imaging. BMW might use it for their cars. So the idea was that we really are the intermediary that finishes these quantum sensors and makes them reliably. So this is something that we already offer. We have products in the market where you can buy ready-to-be-used quantum sensors. That's where we are right now. But then talking to these end users, we also realized the big value lies in integrating these sensors into a device that you actually use. Yeah, so we realized also talking to the automotive industry, they would never actually buy these quantum sensors in themselves, but rather have some final use that they can just plug and play into their existing manufacturing line, into their technologies. And then we came across the need to actually build an integrated imaging system. So not only the core itself, let's call it lens maybe or an objective, but integrated and then not only provide the hardware, but also the software that comes with it. So we started with the ready-to-be-used quantum sensors, but now granularly moved into integrating it into a device that you can think of as a microscope, where you can then do ultra-precise measurements in a variety of fields.
Cool. So the products that you have are nitrogen vacancies in diamonds, right? Could you maybe walk through how they work and how you make them?
Yep, sure. Exactly. As you said, we use these vacancies in synthetic diamond materials. That's one particular or one highly studied quantum sensor. And what we do in the end is we buy synthetic diamond material. So that's commonly available. It's used in other verticals in drilling. These synthetic diamonds are used for a longer period. And then we actually change the diamond structure on an atomic level. So we shoot in nitrogen atoms into the carbon lattice, and then we actually take out the neighboring atom so that they form a so-called nitrogen vacancy center. And that's the core component of our sensor. So it's only two atoms in size. You have the nitrogen atom, you have the neighboring vacancy. And what these two atoms have is a so-called spin. Yeah, so in the end, they have a spin that we can use for measurement. If you're not a quantum physicist, I like to call it a kind of compass needle. Yeah, so think about a compass needle that reacts to the magnetic fields that are exposed to. And the core diamond that we have is, in terms of dimensions, roughly 4 by 4 millimeters. And it contains over 10 billion of these little spins, these compass needles, that we can use to basically measure magnetic fields very precisely.
So if your product is just two atoms wide or smaller two atoms, you've probably got the world's smallest product ever. You should be in the Guinness Book of Records for that, I think.
That's a very good idea. I never thought about it, but we should definitely at least try to get a challenge out there. Yeah. But I think this is a very interesting point because in the end, we think that sensors cannot get any smaller than these two atoms, right? We use many of them to average and to have it on a broader scale. But I think in general, we have a sensor that cannot really be smaller in the long run.
One thing that's interesting is NV sensors are used also for entanglement distribution. Okay, this is a sensor, it's a local device. Do you have any advantage to perhaps like entangling multiple of the sensors that are nearby? I know there's distributed sensing, which is an idea, but that's also not a local thing. But perhaps there's an advantage if you can control multiple NV sensors at the same time and entangle them. Does anything pop up in that domain?
I think this is still on a research level. So I'm not aware of any industry use case where we already have that. So in the end, we don't entangle the spins or the qubits we have, but rather they independently react to the magnetic field they are exposed to. But of course, this is definitely something we have in mind when trying to improve the sensitivity.
Okay, Kevin, I can imagine all of the different NV centers in the diamond material reacting to call it a global magnetic field or a change in magnetic field. How do you take a reading from all of them at the same time? Do they produce some kind of, is it a voltage which comes out of the material, or is it more complicated than that?
It's actually, from the setup, relatively simple. So what we do is we take the diamond that contains the little defects. We hit this diamond with a green laser, so that kind of excites all these spins to an initial state. And then we basically expose it to the magnetic field. So if you want to test an integrated circuit, it produces a magnetic field. And then these spins basically change or react to it. And what we then do in a second step is we take a picture of this synthetic diamond, because in the end, the fluorescence that comes from putting the green laser at the quantum sensor is defined by the fluorescence, the intensity of the fluorescence. So to put it very simple, we take a picture, and the intensity of the red light that is coming from the diamond can be mapped to the magnetic field that is directly in close contact to the diamond sensor.
Fascinating. Okay, so it's a single shot point in time measurement in a graphical state. How do you do you monitor the magnetic field in time at all sometimes? Do you have do you record video or maybe lots of snapshots and then analyze them together somehow?
Yeah, so I think what we do right now is actually we take multiple pictures per second. So the frame rate is relatively high of the cameras we use. But I think in the end, what takes a lot of time is evaluating the data. So really interpreting it. So what we could do is actually a dynamic monitoring. And this is, of course, also interesting for many different use cases. If you can in real time, look at processes, be it in integrated circuits and biology, chemistry. But there we still have to do a lot of development. So right now we rather take one shot, we evaluate, we do the post-processing, and then we take the second one maybe half an hour later. But this is something where also people from the different fields are excited about, to have real-time, non-destructive imaging of whatever you want to investigate.
Nice. I've learned with just a little bit of research in magnetometry that there's a bit of a scale between resolution and sensitivity. Where do these NV centers sit? What kind of resolution can they go down to in terms of the area of the magnetic field that they're reading, and how sensitive are they in terms of the strength of it?
Yeah. So in general, in terms of resolution, we are on a nanoscale. Yeah. So in the end, we are talking about diffraction. We are diffraction limited, or we were last year. Diffraction limit is roughly 400 nanometers. There are a couple of innovations that we came across to bring it down to 200 nanometer resolution. But what we will, on a physics level, never be able to do is imaging on a single digit nanometer. On the physics side, but also, and this is the big struggle we have right now, on the processing power. In the end, we generate per pixel so much information. If we do 4x4 millimeter imaging on a nanometer scale, it's just terabytes of data that are generated within a fraction of a second. So there's a physics limit. We will not do nanometer scale imaging, or single digit nanometer imaging. But also the core challenge right now is actually doing all the processing.
So in that processing stage, when I think of having to do things faster, is usually move to GPU or some other type of performance enhanced or performance specific hardware. Do you have to leverage any of those types of hardware for post-processing, or is it possible to use just traditional techniques for just a lot of matrix multiplication or things like this that have to go on and to filter the images? What techniques are there?
So one approach we definitely look at right at the moment is physics-informed machine learning. So if we are, for example, looking at multi-layer integrated circuits, we can basically train a machine learning algorithm how to separate the information of the different fields. So in the semiconductor use case, for example, you want to see per layer of the chip, what would I expect in terms of magnetic fields? And we can use that to go from our camera image, that is naturally just a picture, so no 3D information, to then come to the point where we separate the signal information of the different layer. And there we use this approach of integrating physics rules into the machine learning algorithms. That's one point. We are also looking at software approaches to do only selective processing. So really identifying already at the camera stage, where do we see some deviations from the magnetic fields we would expect, to basically cut down on the data that we capture in the first place.
Do you think these techniques can lead to real-time analysis, or something has to be invented to make it fast enough for that?
No, I think we are optimistic that what is out there is already very good, right? There are even post-processing approaches to increase the resolution. So there are a lot of approaches from different fields. I mean, in the end, if you think about it, we do image processing, right? So this is not something we have to invent from scratch. In particular, if we do a kind of comparison of what you would expect versus what is there, identifying the failures is relatively straightforward, I would say.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, the amount of evolution from image processing in the machine learning field, I think it's probably been tremendous in the last 5 years with all the computer vision and techniques. I'm sure there's a lot that can apply to sensing, image processing for sensing.
Yeah, as soon as we generated the camera image, it's not about sensing in the first place anymore, right?
Yeah.
It's about processing the image, maybe integrating it to the software or the analytics tools that the respective customers are using it anyways. And then it's far away from conventional sensing analysis.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the semiconductor use cases. Can we just do a bit of a deep dive into that? I'm keen to know, you know, the details of how it works. I'm sure our listeners would be interested. But then also, is this the primary use case for you? And what does that look like globally for quantum diamonds?
Yeah, very happy to. So as I said earlier, so we looked at all the different verticals and many of the end users were excited from an innovation perspective. So really to see, oh, there's a new technology. It has quantum in the name, so we would have to look into this, right? There was in biology and chemistry, the same in automotive. So everyone was open to have a first technical discussion. But when we talked to the semiconductor industry, we really saw that they have a problem that is worth trying to be solved. So we talked to a couple of the big names in the industry, and they told us basically about the problem. So they said, we have more complex chip architectures. We start to put different layers on top of each other. We start to put metallization layers in the devices. And this leads to the fact that optical techniques don't really work anymore. Yeah? So if you think about classical microscopes, optical approach, you cannot investigate more than the top layer of the chip. But if you want to make sure that the more complex architectures work reliably, that you have connected the different layers, no opens, no shorts in the layer further down, then you would need a non-destructive way of testing these integrated circuits. And there the alternatives are often deconstructive. So you really have to cut the chip into pieces. And then, of course, you cannot really learn from it in operando. So once you deconstructed the chip, that doesn't work, of course. And this is where we started, basically, to understand with the big names in the industry, how can a solution look like? And then we are going more into a kind of imaging device rather than just selling them one of these quantum sensors. And yep, it's really about more complex architectures, multi-layer. There's a trend called backside power delivery, where you try to put the power delivery of the chips to the back to make even more space for the transistors of the top size. The top side. So these are technology advancements that require this nanoscale imaging in a non-destructive manner.
Nice. Did you allude earlier on to somehow integrating the sensing layer into the product, or is it more integrated into the manufacturing process equipment so that it's like a chip or a wafer can come across into a sensing component in the manufacturing floor, and then it's all sensed in one go? Or are you baking in the nitrogen vacancies somehow to the actual chips themselves?
Yeah, so I think that's a very interesting thought. And I know there are a couple of papers who do exactly that, integrating a layer of NVs into chips, right? It has, I think, a huge implication in terms of the manufacturing process. So it makes everything more complex. We are at the moment rather on a, I would say, tooling level, right? So we use the NV centers as the sensing head, and then you can similarly to a microscope put one of the samples into this device and then do measurements. I think this also very much aligns with how the failure analysis labs and the design verification labs work in the semiconductor field, because you have the different tools. You have microscopes, you have emission microscopes, you have all these different tools, and ours could be placed basically next to it. And so you say, I have the conventional tools, I need the one that is highly sensitive, non-destructive, so you put it next to it. I think it's easier than integrating it into the chip themselves.
Yeah, I was just interested to know if there were benefits in doing that, you think, at some point. The papers you mentioned, I don't think I've read them. Are these kind of experimental techniques, if you like, research work rather than with a particular goal in mind?
I think it's research-based, but what the big advantage would be is that you're closer to the signal. So one challenge that we have, and it's just in the nature of physics, the further we are away from the signal source, the more the magnetic field blurs and the more the resolution drops. Right? So if we are a couple of millimeters away from the signal source, our resolution drops, whereas if we would have a NV layer in all of the different layers, so to say, and we can basically approach one of these layers in a specific manner, then of course the resolution would be way higher. So I think this is the big advantage, but still, from the manufacturing point of view, I would say, be too complex for like semiconductor fabs.
Yeah, I guess that's the inverse cube law, isn't it, of magnetic field. But ultimately, you're going to be very close to the source anyway when you're measuring a chip or a wafer. You're going to be resting your sensors directly on the product or nanometers away. Essentially.
Yeah. So for the first layer, it always works perfectly. But if we want to go into the layer further down, of course, the standoff distance can become like a couple of microns, sometimes even millimeters. And depending on the strength of the currents, of course, this is already quite a distance, right? So it's always a complex combination of current strength and standoff distance. But in general, we can be very close.
Yeah. High precision kind of activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of the competing technologies, I'm interested to know your insights there, because I know that there are lots of different types of magnetic sensors when it comes to quantum sensing. Why pick NVs? Secondly, why pick Diamond? And is there a stack up against the other technologies that would be interesting to share?
Yeah, sure. So the way we think about it is we always talk about direct alternative technologies and indirect alternative technologies. So for the direct alternative technologies, they also measure magnetic fields. So you have GMR sensors, you have SQUID sensors that basically also can give you information about the magnetic fields. The big disadvantage of GMR sensors is the low sensitivity. So it's a very good approach, but the sensitivity is not really high enough, in particular for the semi use case. And for the SQUID sensors, you can, in the end, you also have a non-destructive method, but the resolution is rather on the micron scale, and we would need to go down to the nano scale. So this is for direct alternative technologies. In terms of indirect alternative technologies, you have often, in particular in the semi-use case, thermal imaging. Yeah? So you use infrared radiation. It's also same issue, very low resolution. So we're talking about maybe micron, sometimes even only millimeter resolution. And it's also destructive. So if you do a destructive measurement on a integrated circuit, you cannot use it afterwards. And similar for TEM or SEM measurements. So you have the electron microscopic approaches and same there. So if you deconstruct the chip, it's okay for failure analysis if you want to do some tests for one, two chips. But if you think about large scale improvements and high throughput semiconductor manufacturing, then of course the deconstructive approaches are not really feasible for large scale production.
It made me laugh using the terminology deconstructed chip. It reminded me of that kind of trend in cooking where they have a deconstructed tiramisu or something, where they have the separate cream and the separate cake and the separate chocolate. Ultimately, you're destroying it. It's not a tiramisu anymore. It's not a semiconducting chip anymore. It's just a piece of rubbish that's been broken up.
Yeah, and you have very good approaches there to go down to like single digit nanometer resolution, right? But in the end, it's not something you can use for each and every chip.
One thing that always comes up is it's always non-trivial to just put the technology in place that's new. What type of challenges have you faced, and what challenges are to still overcome before you get exactly the product you want?
Yeah, so I would really separate between the different use cases. So you can use it, or what we currently look at is design verification and failure analysis. So really next to the manufacturing line of a chip manufacturer. So that's there we solve the challenge of having a compact device that kind of looks like a microscope where you can put in single samples, you can do the evaluation. It doesn't take you a couple of hours, but rather a couple of minutes. That already works also in the lab. But the main challenge, or where we want to go as a startup, as a company, is more towards inline quality control. So you have your lithography machines, you have the electrical testing, like in the very end. But to really do inline quality control, help to accelerate the yields, I think this is something where we have still significant challenges. If you think about a very fast manufacturing line, we need to increase the size of our sensors. So 4x4 millimeter compared to a wafer is, yeah, we would have to stitch a lot. So it would take a lot of time. And then also in terms of evaluation time, we would be way quicker. So I think right now we are in the order of half an hour. So I think there we just have to go down, best case, to single digit minutes.
Is it a matter of just more compute and more efficient algorithms? Having just watched the GTC NVIDIA event with new GPUs coming out, I imagine you've got a kind of, you're looking at that already and thinking, how can we enhance our processing, post-processing time?
Yeah, that's a very interesting part, because in the end, we can use GPUs to manufacture GPUs more efficiently, right? So you have a continuous loop. But yeah, this is exactly that. It's about processing power, but also right now it's still an issue to manufacture these synthetic diamonds on a bigger scale, because you would always have to have an electronic grade diamond substrate. You would have to incorporate these little NV centers in a kind of homogeneous matter. So there's also on the hardware engineering side a lot of things, but the more exciting part for us right now is just the speed at which these post-processing steps are like new alternatives come up. And this is something where we cannot really estimate, also when we talk to our investors, how much faster can we get? How much more can we improve the resolution through post-processing? So pretty excited on the software side, but some, I would say, basic homework on the hardware side is also still needed.
I'm interested to know a little bit about the, you're taking an image of the fluorescence. So it's not like you're taking any telemetry.
Yeah, so what we have to do in the post-processing is we take the picture. Yeah? So we have a 2D picture, I would say. And then in the post-processing, we have to translate for every single picture that we have, or for every single, I forgot the name. So we take the picture, and for every pixel of the image, we would have to translate the fluorescent intensity to the magnetic field. And this for each and every pixel on a 4x4 millimeter, if you want to do nanoscale imaging, this is a lot of processing. So there comes the complexity in terms of software.
And is it a simple scale between zero to a particular number? You've got a scale of fluorescence and it's just mapping for every single pixel.
That's the base approach. We basically sweep kind of microwave frequency, and then we see some drops. So there's a lot of like post-processing, but in general, that's the easy way to think about it, is that we can map the intensity to the magnetic field strength per pixel.
And how about finding defects? Is it a simple matter of you know exactly what a perfect chip would look like, and therefore you compare your output for all of the individual pixels against that kind of blueprint, or is it more complicated than that?
So we are still in the early stages of this analytics layer, where we proactively even want to suggest some failure modes we might expect from a specific design. But what we do right now is exactly what you described. So we have a known good die. We can do simulations on what we would expect in terms of magnetic fields. And then we directly overlay this with the actual measurements. And then you can very nicely see deviations. It's very clear. The harder part is then analyzing why and what exactly is happening there, right? So you see deviations in terms of magnetic field very clear, and also there are very good papers that show what other approaches cannot detect and then what quantum sensors can detect. But the what we want to provide as a startup is the analytics, what happened there. Is it an open? Is it a short? Is it an issue with the interconnect? Is it a material defect? And this is something we learn over time from just measuring and measuring thousands of chips. That's the end state. But there we are just in the very beginning.
Yeah. One question about the process. When you set up the system to take these images, do you have to cool it down for the NV Center to be in a quantum state, or what type of environment is it in?
Yeah, that's actually one big advantage that we didn't even discuss yet. So we can operate at room temperatures. Yeah? So there's no need to cool the system down. So that's a very neat thing, because if you want to, if you have to cool down in a semiconductor fab, the analysis lab, I think this would be a huge challenge. And also in terms of clean room needs, of course, in a clean room, everything's way easier. But just from the approach, we can also operate in non-clean room environments.
Because I would imagine also in the cooled environment, maybe the semiconductors don't work the same way as if they were integrated into a room temperature system.
Yeah, that's true. It's very easy for us to do these measurements at room temperature, the very same temperature that the chips in the end would be operating in now.
So what about additional use cases, Kevin? I guess you're already looking at potential diversification when it comes to use cases, right? Which industries you're looking at? You mentioned a few at the beginning. Have you decided already on where you want to focus R&D yet, or are you still 100%? I'd imagine you're still 100% focused on your semiconducting manufacturing use case. But yeah, keen to hear thoughts.
Yep, sure. Also, there we separate our thoughts into two categories. One being the imaging approaches. So if you think about a microscope that you might know from biology class in school, you image, so you basically have a sample holder and you can put in whatever you want. So you can put in a blood sample, you can put in a chemistry probe or any chemistry material you want to investigate. So this is the kind of the use cases that are adjacent to what we do right now in the quantum sensing field. There you can do high throughput NMR spectroscopy. So you can look at how do enzymes grow over time, or how do cells or molecules change dynamically in real time in the best case. So it's always taking our imaging system that we have for the semiconductor use case and preparing the samples you want to investigate. Of course, it comes with challenges, but it's the very same approach then to come from the camera, the picture, the fluorescence to an analysis. So this is pretty straightforward. And there we are currently discussing with people from biology and chemistry, but we didn't decide on a use case. We have it in mind, but 80-90% of the focus goes into the semi use case. The exciting part or something for the longer term is using these quantum sensors, but not in an imaging approach, but use them as a kind of standalone, so to say, compass needle, or like a sensing system where you don't do imaging, but you just use one of these sensors that has a lot of pros and cons. But there are very cool applications. You can do navigation in GPS-free, GPS-denied environments. Yeah? So let's say GPS doesn't work anymore. We could use the sensor to map it to the magnetic field of the Earth where you are right now, and then see where you move from there. So this is an exciting, very cool use case, but it's not an imaging approach. It's using this entire sensing system to do measurements, but this is not something that we currently target, because it requires way more engineering than making the imaging system suitable for biology tests or something.
Yeah, my thoughts are, first of all, with the semiconducting world, you're dealing with precision manufactured pieces of equipment. You know exactly what to expect, where and when, for every single pixel as you put them. With the biology use case, that's way more dynamic, right? My question is, you'd still be using the magnetic fields. So what type of things would you be looking for and able to detect? Or it may be that you're enhancing other imaging techniques that they use, maybe to get another perspective on whatever's happening in the Petri dish.
Yeah. I think this is the big question that is still at the, so I would say, academic level. So there is no And this is the big difference to the semiconductor use case. There is no current tool that is in the field that clearly doesn't perform at one of the challenges that we could basically solve, right? So exactly this is the question that we also ask the biology labs, is what is the advantage of having a non-destructive measurement system on the nanoscale that you would pay for like €500,000, right? So there are very good approaches in biology where you don't have nanoscale imaging because they don't need nanoscale. It's just like too good for them, right? So they are not willing to pay for it. I think this is something that we have to see over time and describe what additional insights can we generate. And there, it is not 100% clear what this is.
On the GNSS-free or GPS-free type environment, that's such an exciting use case for lots of different industries, shipping, underground metros, defense, and so on. My understanding is that NV sensors perhaps are not sensitive enough for that one. But I think regardless of whichever one you use, you mentioned SQUID, you mentioned GMR. So that's the classical magnetic field detection, isn't it? And then OPMs as well. And of course, some of them are more sensitive to the NVs. And I think that may mean that they're more suitable to the navigation ones, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. So I think in general, this GPS denied environment navigation is also what we are excited about to talk about, because it sounds pretty cool. Yeah, but the question is then, what is the use case? Are we sensitive enough? I know that the US Department of Defense has looked into this with a couple of tens of millions of budget, and they couldn't get down to 10 or 20 meter of precision, right? So it's still like 200 meters here and there you might be. So it's really a kind of worst case scenario where there's no GPS and this has to be the alternative to navigate. So there is a lot of dual use and some defense thinking, yeah, that in a worst case, this can be of help. But as you said, in terms of alternatives, I think NVs are not inherently the ones you would basically use for an alternative to GPS.
And it's an interesting topic. I want to explore this more, I think, in due course. With GNSS-free environments, it's not just about the magnetic field. That's a very interesting data set to work from, but it's also your inertia and your movement. And if you can somehow calculate that very accurately, then you can cope with just an occasional connection to the GNSS or some kind of reference point. But hey, I'm just spitballing now.
No, but I totally agree. And also there, I think the post-processing and this physics-informed machine learning can help to increase the resolution or the sensitivity. So this is something where on the post-processing, it can lead to the fact that it actually outperforms or is more attractive. But so far, we didn't look too deeply into this just because it's a kind of threat scenario that the entire GPS system is not working anymore. And then we would be being the alternatives. I think it's a bit more pleasant to think about a civil use case where there's semiconductor manufacturing that you can help to improve.
Yeah. And so one thing that came to my mind now, you mentioned using GPU to help fix GPU, but can you use quantum sensing to enhance quantum computing, for example? So these superconducting qubits need to be manufactured in a way that keeps the error rates of the qubits very low. It's very important for the success of quantum computing. Can we do quantum computing in the first place? So do you think your technology could be used to help manufacture quantum computer chips?
Yeah, so this is really off the print, I would even say. So I think there was a paper published last week where they used our quantum sensing approach to actually manufacture chips. So in the end, no matter if you have quantum computing chips or conventional chips, in the manufacturing process, it's a very similar approach. We, in general, have been a bit cautious to, I would even say, entangle quantum sensing and quantum computing too much. So I think it has pros and cons from a funding perspective. There's a lot of funding in quantum, and you get a lot of open doors if you say we do quantum because there's a lot of interest in it. But at the same time, we are so close, or like even in the industrial use cases, that people often connect quantum with in 10 years, something will happen, right? So we're a bit careful there. But of course, there is the chip manufacturing, also the manufacturing of chips for QC. Yeah.
Yeah, I see your point because quantum computing is not applicable right now. So if you tie too closely to quantum computing, might be held back. Where in your case, you have applications for today. But I see that the same process, right? The quantum chips, you probably even need more or fewer defects, let's say, than the classical technologies, because the error correction techniques for quantum will be much harder to overcome or to solve than the classical ones that already exist.
Yeah, so we have that like in the back, but right now, of course, the customer interest comes from more complex architectures, also new materials. We didn't talk about gallium nitride, silicon carbide, more energy efficient materials. So I think before we focus on manufacturing quantum computing chips, there's still a lot of other use cases within the semi field that we would explore.
Yeah, I'd expect in the quantum computing world, it's a totally different ballgame, isn't it? Because you've got to look at Josephson junctions are probably the elements that you'd have to measure. And they have to be triggered somehow with microwave. And they probably needed, I don't even know whether looking at the magnetic field is useful in that manufacturing domain.
Yeah.
It may be.
Also there, it's very exciting, as you said, from a research perspective, but there's no commercial use case right now. So we monitor it, we look at the papers, but yeah, it's not top of mind, I'd say.
You want to go where the high volume is as well, of course.
Yes.
Okay. So there's always interest about how companies get off the ground and the paths that take always shift and making decisions. So you had mentioned about the Exist program, which is a nice way to kick off a company without having to risk too much because you get the stability from the university and the salary. But Quantum Diamonds has gone through the Intel Ignite program. How do you think that has helped the company kick off? I guess it helps. From our perspective, it looks like it takes tech founders and helps them to take their tech to a business. Is that something that helped you or what's your opinion?
Yeah, so what I think about corporate accelerator programs, first of all, they don't take any equity. So I think this is very important also in terms of fundraising that you're not bound to any of the corporates. They have the requirement that you need to have at least, I think, $5 million in funding. So they want to help you to go from 5 people to 20 or 25. So this program had a lot of components around team building, onboarding, how to manage as a CTO, as a CEO, a deep tech company. So from that perspective, I think it was different than the, I would say, usual program where you say we do a bit of pitching and we reach out to investors. It was really about you have the budget, you have the office and the lab. Like, how do you get to a specific speed very quickly? So there it helped definitely. And the other part of the program is the use case within Intel or the application of the technology within Intel. So they have a strong incentive to find the respective counterpart in the organization and check on the technology. So I cannot reveal that much, but of course they also took our technology and tried to see what is the best use within the organization. And this is something that we found very helpful because if you think about Intel as an organization, it's huge. How do I get to that person? Sometimes you don't even understand their job title. So that really helped to understand where can we be used and also where can we not be used? Where are some physical limits or engineering issues, willingness to pay? So all of this helped to come up with a roadmap for the next 2 years that is aligned with one of the big potential customers.
I know one problem with startups is, especially coming from a university, is how to bring your product down to earth. How do you make it a reality as soon as possible so that investors have interest in it? Did it help shape your product? You didn't mention it, but did you have, say, 90% of everything ready to go and then they gave you some ideas for 10%, or did it really help the company in a significant way to pivot into the right market?
In terms of funding or strategy or...
Basically, product development, product roadmap, shaping the product so that it can be sold in 2 years, 5 years.
Yeah. So I think they had really helped because in the end, what I was trying to push from the very beginning, in particular as a non-quantum physicist, is what is the problem we're solving, right? So we have these 15 quantum physicists in the team. They really like to read papers and come up with new, cool approaches. And we as a team have aligned that we have the need to focus on the customer. So there, we, of course, talk to them, like, what is the best solution? If you would have a wish list, what would you actually need? And align that with the product roadmap. But I would also stress that it's important to make sure that you don't develop a product just for one customer. So even if in the IntelIgnite program, we got a lot of feedback where we would have to be in terms of product, there are still other customers that you should talk to. So I think it helped us, but we were aware that there might be the tendency to develop something just for the one customer, just because it was easy to get access.
Interesting.
Yeah, I love that. You've got to think about risk management and so on at a very early stage, haven't you? And not betting on one horse, so to speak.
In particular, and also this is not a surprise or something new. It's a highly dense, consolidated industry with a couple of big players, right? So you can actually talk to your top 20 customers in a year. So it's not a consumer business. Yeah. So you have, if you're a supplier to let's say Intel at some point, they bring you in all of the different fabs. So like talking to all of these 20 customers in the first place to align your roadmap is something that's feasible from a time and budget perspective.
Okay. Well, let's wrap up. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us. That's been a fascinating talk with you and a little view into the world of quantum sensing. And I will watch your company with close interest in due course. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye for now. I'd like to take this moment to thank you for listening to the podcast. Quantum networking is such a broad domain, especially considering the breadth of quantum physics and quantum computing, all as an undercurrent, easily to get sucked into. So much is still in the research realm, which can make it really tough for a curious IT guy to know where to start. So hit subscribe or follow me on your podcast platform, and I'll do my best to bring you more prevalent topics in the world of quantum networking. Spread the word, it would really help us out.